Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, the luxurious Luke Cutforth.
I have a very expensive taste.
This week, we're talking about free funds and pseudo-socialism, but first, we have a wee review.
Oh, I know what this is, but where's the wee review from?
This one comes from Apple Podcasts. It's 5 stars, and it says, an amazing podcast, part of my daily schedule. It goes on to say, Luke, I love your podcast so much. I discovered them about a month and a half ago, but I listened to the pod to go to sleep while getting ready in the morning and sometimes to just relax. I very much like how you talk about science that isn't about science. As a science lover myself, it's great to apply it to what I see every day in the world. And then a small, smiley face. It's a colon, and then a D.
That's a big smiley face.
A very large smile.
Very happy with our podcast, and I'm very happy with your review. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you're happy with this question, Luke. And the question is something you can answer on YouTube or on Spotify, or if you're not on either of those places, you're listening. You just need to do this one thing, which is overthrow the government, replace money with notes. And the notes are your answer to the question. Just write your answer on the notes, and that will be money. And I guess I'll have to see it at some point. I don't use cash, but I do come across it every now and then. Maybe in the next 10 years, I'll see it. The question, Luke, is what would you do if you had UBI?
Broadly, what I do now. I'm very lucky to do something I really enjoy, a series of things. I really enjoy.
Oh, this podcast.
Yeah.
You enjoy it.
Yeah.
You do.
Yeah, I'm not just here against my will.
You really, really enjoy it.
Yeah.
So even if I were to like unlock all the doors and let you out and see your family, you would stay and you would do the podcast?
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
With the UK in another cost of living crisis facilitated by myopic, misanthropic, or outright malignant politicians and caused in part by disgustingly greedy corporations artificially inflating prices, now might be a good time to have a peek at what science has to say about free money, otherwise known as UBI. I wrote that. Sounded smart, didn't it?
It did sound very smart. You did that without AI as well.
No AI. Just this.
Just I. Wow.
The brain as the... not the point, Luke. Not the point. The point is that we're talking about UBI today, and I have another question for you to answer. This one is, what is UBI? I've got a definition already, of course, but how would you describe UBI?
Okay, so it comes in various different forms, but broadly I would say that it is a...
I also come on various different forms. I'm not allowed to go to the post office anymore.
Okay, well, UBI, if you can contain yourself for 20 seconds, I would say broadly is like a payment that you receive probably from a government that is designed to give you generally just your absolute basic needs for free, like without any sort of necessity. You don't have to do any work for it. And it's sort of coming in, especially when the world is potentially transitioning to artificial intelligence, taking up a lot of the jobs. And everyone would get it. It's for basic needs, basic. And it is an income. It is a source of money for you to use.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I would have described UBI as, before I had a look into this episode. And I'm not saying that in terms of, actually, you're wrong now that I've learned things. What I mean is that's a sort of very, I don't want to say simple view, but UBI can be broader than that, even though what you've described is literally what the words universal basic income should mean, right? So this isn't sort of an indictment of you insofar as it's an indictment of people who stretch the definition of UBI to something that is not UBI anymore. It's like saying, I don't know, a living wage that isn't actually a wage one can live on. You know, it's like people that do things like that. That's what I have an issue with. Let's go through UBI, get into a bit more of what it actually is. So the IMS say that universal basic income is an income support mechanism typically intended to reach all or a very large portion of the population with no or minimal conditions. Those brackets there are doing a lot of, all or a lot of them with no conditions or some, maybe some conditions, you know. But to be fair, some of those conditions could be something like you are a resident of this place.
Sure.
Or, you're not a billionaire,
There might even be like the similar sort of conditions we have now where like you have to have an address, for example, which is very difficult. People who don't have an address and sort of stops you getting the help that you actually kind of do have a right to.
Yes, no, look, you're absolutely right. It's really difficult as well to sign up to lots of things without address. I think a bank account is difficult to get without address. Mm-hmm. Like, even like a credit card, not that that's a good thing or something you want to have. And if you don't have an address, it's difficult to that. GP, right? All of the, like, you need to have a place that you live to be able to engage in society. And if you don't have a fixed address, yeah, you're right. It could be really difficult to get things. And UBI, especially, you know, if it's coming through the government, would also probably have those things attached. I mean, you'd need, like, unless it's cash in hand, which is a really difficult thing to work out, you know, you'd need to have some kind of bank account or something along those lines to receive any.
It.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. As we've kind of talked, Ryan, though, there are a bunch of different ways of implementing UBI, and different methods could have different results. And the definition is very, very broad, potentially too broad, as I've kind of alluded to. So, you know, lots of different things can be grouped together under the banner of UBI. Do you have any ideas of, like, different ways that you could sort of implement UBI, you know, determine who receives it, or, you know, providing it by certain means?
So other than, for example, just transferring money, people, you could have something like food stamps.
Okay.
They have this in Norway, for example, where there's a way of you getting, like, you get like a special charge card that has a certain amount of money on it that you receive each month, but you're only allowed to spend it in a sort of grocery store setting. You can't, and you can't get it out as cash.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way you, I suppose, you could implement it, like putting restrictions on the types of thing you could spend your UBI on.
See, to me, I would say, and this is me personally, I would say that wouldn't necessarily fall under UBI because it's not really sort of income then. Do you know what I mean? That it's almost a voucher, right? To me, I would say that UBI would pretty strictly have to be money.
Right.
Without sort of conditions, you know, like, here is money. But what I'm talking about more is sort of, you said payments, so it could be a one-off payment, right? So when you reach adulthood, here, when you're 18, here is a one-off payment. It could be sort of consistent payments. Here is a monthly payment or an annual payment, right? So different sort of different ways of providing it, by which I mean sort of like, you know, one-off or in, you know, annually or weekly, monthly, anything like that. And determining who receives it as well. Do you have any idea, like, how different ways of sort of figuring out who gets UBI?
Well, without breaking the word, the U part, universal, I don't know. No, because you wouldn't necessarily have it as income-based because then it's not universal.
Mm.
And you wouldn't, you might have it as age-based so that you only get it once you're 18. And if you're lower than 18, maybe your parents get a bit more or your carer gets a little bit more, like a child tax credit that we have now. But no, I don't know other than that.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the thing as well. The word universal there, one would imagine it means everyone. But if we go by the definition of it being sort of, not necessarily everyone, but mostly everyone, you know, yeah. It could be categorical. So this is a group of people, and here is a, you know, a universal basic income for this group of people. So, you know, people, I don't really know any category of
like
person off the top of my head.
Adults.
Yeah, but more, you could even be more specific than that, you know, like you could look at a group of people in your society and you're like, this group of people need a leg up. So, boom, there you go. People in poverty and stuff like that. But then it becomes less universal and it's kind of more akin to sort of social safety nets that we've already got in place, which are means tested, right?
Yeah, well, what's so interesting about that, and I'm sure we're going to get onto this, is that part of the attraction of UBI is, and the universal part, is that we spend an awful lot of money on people who check whether people should have benefits or not.
Yeah.
We have all these, like, bureaucrats who basically go, oh, actually, you're not quite disabled enough, we're not going to give you it. Oh, you're actually not this enough, we're not going to give you it.
Mm.
And that costs a lot of money to employ these people who sit behind desks and look at forms and judge whether people are allowed to have it. And one of the sort of reasons advocating for UBI is that, yes, it costs a lot of money to do UBI, but actually you also save a lot of money on the bureaucracy of having a means-tested system.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're definitely going to get into that more later, so I won't add on to that now. But yeah, no, you're so totally right. And to kind of talk more about sort of the different ways that UBI can sort of exist, right? The different sort of presentations of it. Yeah, you know, you could have one-off payments, tax credits, as you've said. Do you know what negative income tax is? Have you heard of that?
Yeah, well, that's similar to sort of tax credit, I suppose, which is like when you pay your tax, if you have some credits in some form, then your tax bill comes down.
Yeah, so I think the way that I've read that it works is you've got a line, let's say, this is the sort of minimum amount, or the average amount, right? And below that, so the people above that line pay income tax, and the people below that essentially get paid.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, so that would be like, so right now in the UK, for example, we have about a £12,000 cutoff, where you, the first £12,000 you don't pay any tax on
yeah.
it. And so that would be that if you earned, say, eight, because you can see that as, say, a £2,500-ish tax credit, right? Mm-hmm. So if you imagine that you actually paid tax on all your money, but on the first £12,000, you didn't pay any tax, mm-hmm. you can see that the government's kind of given you £2,500 tax refund. And so the way...
If you're a simp, you can look at it that way, yeah.
Sure. But and then you could imagine that, okay, if you earned £8,000, well, you've still been allowed that £2,500 tax refund. Mm. And so they give you the difference back. You maybe get £500 back. That's a way that
yeah, yeah, kind of like that, absolutely. And then categorical, we've kind of already spoken about like sort of a different sort of broad categories of people, and they're not necessarily means testing, you know, just being like, I don't want to say this, but like, all black people, there you go. UBI for you. Not sure. that is something that would or should be done, but I'm just pulling an example out of thin air.
Yeah.
Let's not dwell on it too much. And then there's participation income, as it's described, which I'll get onto in a second, right? But it's quite an interesting concept. But according to the IMF, two common traits characterize and differentiate universal basic income type programs from others. Universality, obviously, or very large coverage of individuals in society, and unconditionality, or very broadly conditioned provisions. So the idea here is, you know, we've got kind of social safety nets already, you know, we've got benefit systems both in the US and in the UK, and in other countries, one would assume, but I don't know that much about them, man. Who knows? Germany? Probably. They probably have that there. Sweden? Maybe. Norway? What did Norway? You know about Norway, Luke. Do they have a social safety net there?
I don't know much about Norway. I've been once. I think they have very good social provisions.
You went there once and you didn't sort of fervently sort of research their welfare programs?
No, funnily enough, I didn't. They have high taxation and a very sort of equal society. Mm. So everyone's kind of doing all right. For example, the average wage in Norway is something like 40-something thousand pounds equivalent. So it's
wow.
about double our average wage. But then things are more expensive and taxes higher.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, more people are doing fine in Norway than other countries.
Yeah, and they probably don't have their fuel companies jacking up the prices just because they feel like it. And their supermarkets doing the same because they can get away with it.
Well, actually, the fuel is owned by the government. So they have a big state-owned fuel company. That's why they're so rich, it's because they found loads of oil and they still have a state-owned fuel company. Everyone, when you go to Norway, if like 50% of people you meet, you go like, where do you work? And they're like, oh, I work for the state-owned fuel company. I can't remember the name. But like literally everyone works for the state-owned fuel company, or at least in my experience. Like,
I love that also in this scenario, they're saying it in English, which yes, they absolutely
they were to me when I was in Norway, because I only knew like two sentences in Norwegian and they're all brilliant in English. I knew how to say, du den beste for sin I verden, which is, you are the best person in the world.
Oh.
And they always
did you hear that often?
No, but I said it to other people. They always said...
I hope no Norwegians you met are watching this. And they're like, oh no, this strange red man that I found. he said it to everyone. I'm not special. You've just ruined several people's
days. No, they normally reply to me, du den beste for sin I verden. You're the worst person in the world. And I said, jeg en man. I am a man.
Yeah, no, there are obviously different sort of welfare programs across different countries. But the key point with a universal basic income is that near enough everybody, if not everybody, just receives it, you know? So instead of, you know, the sort of welfare programs that we've got now, wherein if you're below a certain income, or if you're disabled, or if you have children, the government's like, here's some money, because those things cost more, you know? Especially children. Oh, they cost a lot. Do you know what? I was looking to buy a few kids the other day.
What? Yeah, carry on your story.
And it was illegal.
Oh.
And a very bad thing and a serious problem. And so I didn't do it and I reported them to the appropriate authorities.
The children.
Shut up. You've ruined this hypothetical, just like you ruined Norway. If you remember the sort of definition I gave there, universality or very large coverage of individuals in society, or unconditionality or very broadly conditioned provisions. That would be the sort of two things that differentiate universal basic income from another sort of program, like a welfare program or whatnot. And broadly conditioned provision could mean something like it only being provided on the basis of social participation to those who engage in society. So broadly, that's people who are in employment, education, or childcare. And I don't mean education or childcare as in they work in education or childcare. I mean someone who is looking after children that perhaps they have spawned themselves.
Yes.
Or in education, being educated by educators.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So, you know, basically, pretty much anyone, right? And then also, I guess, disabled people who don't do any of those three things, right? They would hopefully be included as well in this sort of model. The idea there, right, is that it's everyone who's actually sort of doing something or giving something to society or participating socially, right? They would then be eligible for it. And that way you don't have people who, you know, are just kind of wanting to coast off of everyone else's work or, you know, go off and live in the woods and still have the money to survive without engaging in society in some way, right? It avoids that kind of idea of parasites who just want to suck at the government's teat or,
sure,
you know, that kind of imaginary person that doesn't really exist in significant numbers.
Yeah, and it also does the other thing, which is that it incentivizes the things the government wants you to do as well. So it obviously punishes you for not doing those things, and it incentivizes you to do them. And so if you are somebody who's, for example, as you say, sucking at the government's teat, at least if you want to do that, if you don't, for example, want to get a job for whatever reason, you can go into education and you can maybe build your skills, and that might make you find a skill that you actually really enjoy and then want to go into a job. So it's about incentivizing as well as punishing.
Or you could just stay in education forever. Just I've got a PhD, now it's time for a postdoc. Well, I've got postdoc, but now maybe more of the, I'm just going to go for another studying area. I'm going to go for another degree. I'm just going to stay studying until I die.
But, and that's interesting, because although that sounds really weird and bad, it also creates jobs for the people who are teaching you, right? It at least gives them something to do. If you stay in education forever, it gives the teacher someone to teach.
That's like late stage capitalism, but for...
Oh, I know.
It's like marketing, but for education, right? Yeah. Like, you only have a job because we need everyone to have jobs. And also, we need to continue selling things. And the only way to continue selling things is to trick people into thinking they need things. And so now you have a job tricking people into thinking they need things that they don't need, so that you can have a job that you don't need to sell things.
Oh, I know it's a silly circular thing, and eventually someone needs to make something of value, but...
No. We all pass around the same dollar. Look, we're creating so much value.
Pass the same dollar around a million times, everyone's earned $1 million.
Hey, look, I'll pay you $1 to give me a nice little smile.
Hello.
Okay, there's your dollar.
Oh, thank you so much. I've earned $1. I'll give you $1 to go... here's $1.
Okay. And look, I'll give you $1 to continue doing what you're doing.
I'm doing it. Oh, thank you. I've earned $2 now. But there's only $1. How's
and
that
I earned
work?
$1, right? And so that means we've created wealth of,
yes,
like...
$3.
$3.
Congratulations, us.
That's insane.
Wow, wealth creators.
That's mad. And like, so that's like what? Like a 200% increase on the $1 we had already?
Amazing.
That's insane.
Banks could never...
Ding-a-ling-ling, is that the ad bell?
I think it is, but it's rather quiet this time.
Well, Luke, we want to keep a big old secret about this SciGuys merch.
Yes, please do not tell anybody, and do not purchase any of it, otherwise people will find out.
They might see you wearing our merch or displaying our merch and think, oh wow, what a cool person. And I'll tell you this, as a cool person myself, having people think you're a cool person can be very, very stressful.
Yeah, we can't have that. We also can't have you supporting the show to exist that you're enjoying right now.
Yeah, so absolutely, under no circumstances should you go to normalcitizen.store and pick up some SciGuys merch. Some SciGuys merch like beanies and posters and t-shirts and calendars and cool stuff like that. Definitely don't go to that store and buy that.
Goodness me, that's an awful lot of stuff that I'm not going to purchase.
Absolutely, Luke. Now let's get back to the show before anyone listens to us.
God, I really hope we got away with that one.
Anyway, no, yeah, we're talking about broadly conditioned provisions. The idea with a broadly conditioned provision is, you know, basically everyone is able to receive it, you know, so not just people who are working, because that would be maybe a little bit silly to say only if you're able to work do you get the minimum, because some people might not be able to work, and as a safety net, it wouldn't then work.
Yep.
So we understand all of that, right? We've got an idea of what UBI is, even though we've gone off on many tangents already. Do you understand?
Yes, and we're $3 richer too.
Very good. Would you like to recap so we're richer in knowledge also?
Okay, so universal basic income is a payment which is made either universally to everybody or broadly universally to a large group of people, and then broadly without any conditions or with some very, very like slight conditions. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, you must be participating in society and not just being a traveling hermit.
Or you must be able to juggle for at least 1 second.
That's the two. That imagine if that was the rule. you go to your juggling exam to get your UBI.
1 second as well.
That's like the absolute, like that's like a parody of capitalism. It's a parody of the world. Can you juggle? If yes, money.
The reverse kind of seems similar to the sort of things that they use to catch out disabled people, right? You know, to take away their benefits. Mm. Where they're like, I saw you juggling. I looked through your window and I saw you juggling for all of 1 second, which means you can't possibly be disabled enough to not be able to work. So go get a job or starve to death, I suppose. Oh, you took out your bins by yourself? But you said you find things difficult. Go work 5 days a week or die, I suppose. We live in a functional country. Anyway, shall we talk about the history of UBI? Do you know anything about the history of UBI, Luke?
No, but for some reason, vibes-wise, I feel like it was like made in the 70s. I feel like someone came up with it in the 70s. That's like everyone's high, and everyone's like, wow, man, what if we just looked after each other?
I wouldn't fault you for thinking that. I was going to say it's actually probably either a lot younger or a lot older than you'd imagine, yeah. Right? I doubt anyone would really pinpoint the sort of exact time mm-hmm. of it. And you got it very wrong.
Great.
There is a 7 there. It's the late 1700s that it was first suggested.
Whoa.
Locally. Yeah, to the best of our Western knowledge. And that was by Thomas Spence. And then Joseph Charlier brought it to the national level in the mid-1800s. And that's when it was seriously suggested, but the general idea was kicking about for a good while before that. You know, the Basic Income Earth Network mentioned in an article on the origin of UBI that it was around the Renaissance that humanists started considering some kind of minimum payment as a way to help poor people. And as we briefly discussed in our Psych Wards episode, remember that one? The Psych mm-hmm. Wards episode? Yeah. The poor, the disabled, and all of those lot. That sounds really bad. Mm. That sounds really bad. I'm just going to charge on through. At the time, poor people, disabled people, etc., they were pretty exclusively under the care of either the church or charitable individuals, and a lot of people point to Utopia as the sort of origin of the idea of UBI, Utopia being a book from the 16th century by Thomas More. So remember then, right, 16th century was when this idea maybe came about in this book, but like, not really. I've got a quote here that kind of discusses why not really. So I'll read that out for you, Luke. The inhabitants of Utopia all have access to adequate means of subsistence provided in kind, coupled with compulsory labor. This hardly qualifies as an unconditional basic income. Moreover, Moore insists that his finding these institutions fascinating enough to write down their description does not entail that he endorses them. The closest one can find to a serious proposal in that direction is to be found instead in part one of Utopia. Raphael Nonsenso narrates there a conversation he says he had with John Moore and the Archbishop of Canterbury. The provision of means of livelihood to the poor, he argued, would be a more astute way of fighting theft than sentencing thieves to death, which had the unpleasant side effect of increasing the murder rate. So that is all from Basic Income Earth Network. You could find that in linked below or wherever we put the links to all of the things that we used.
Yes, I really hope that people who don't like UBI are jumping on the fact that the original guy who's talked about it is a guy called Raphael Nonsenso.
Fictional character.
Oh, okay.
So the idea kind of maybe came about in the 16th century, right? You know, right about then, the 1500s. And it wasn't until 1700s, 1800s that it was kind of, you know, suggested in an actual context for people to benefit from. We've kind of already spoken about the pros and cons of UBI, or the supposed pros and cons of UBI. You've kind of touched on one of them already, but do you have any other ideas for any arguments for UBI, why it might be better than means-tested schemes, for example?
Well, there's a lot of pros, and I'm sure there are a lot of proposed cons as well. Pros, for example, would be that it frees people up to like pursue things that they actually want to do, because so many people are trapped in jobs that they might not be interested in doing.
But they need money to survive.
Exactly. And so, yeah, the government is threatening them with ultimately death all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, if you can't pay this, then you'll go, or at least prison all the time, right? Mm-hmm. That is the punishment of
prison, starvation, exposure, those.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there may be people who are in a job that is not necessarily perfectly linked to how they naturally would want to be. And there might actually be somebody who would be more suited to that job who also can't get there
yeah.
because they're trapped in their thing, right? Mm-hmm. And there's also a bunch of studies which basically show that this is quite effective as well, which I'm sure we're going to get onto as well. Have you got any more pros that you've suggested?
Yeah, so you suggested earlier on, you mentioned the administration issue, yeah. right? The sort of admin load. So I'm going to just quickly recover that because what we didn't necessarily talk about is admin bottlenecking the process. So you spoke about how these admin costs, you know, trying to figure out who gets something can cost a lot of money and take up a lot of time. And that's a lot of resources that we could divert elsewhere.
Mm.
Totally true. But also the admin stuff that can, the bottleneck that I just mentioned, that can stop people from getting
yeah.
benefits that they're supposed to get. And, you know, I mean, you could look at it in the sense of, well, there's just so much and we can't get through all of it. That certainly does exist. There's also the more evil, shall we say?
Yeah.
I'll be very charitable and say the more evil element of just hiring people to not let people get benefits. You know, hiring people to go and look through people's windows, dig through their bins and whatnot to double check that they're disabled enough to not have to work. And then if they find any evidence that maybe they are able to do something for any amount of time, they'll make sure that they're no longer considered disabled enough to mm-hmm. not have to work and put a disabled person to work when they're not able to. You know, so there's that aspect of it. There's the aspect of, like, you know, if you want to get a personal independence payment, you know, PIP sort of thing in the UK, if you've got any kind of disability and, you know, you want some money from the government to help you get by because your disability costs you extra money. For example, like even ADHD, right? There is costs that are incurred with that where it's like, I've bought a lot of food. I can't cook the food. Oh, the food's gone off. I forgot about the food. I broke it. You know, like all of, people are going to complain about this. People are like, oh, just be more responsible. Be blah, 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 this, that. Why should I have to pay for your disability? Shut up. That's why you have to pay for my disability. I didn't fucking choose this. So why'd I have to pay for you being old, huh? You're going to be disabled when you're old. Everyone's got to pay for that. Like, we're fine paying for disabled people when you call the disabled people old. Old isn't a thing, okay? It's just disabled. Old and disabled are the same thing. It's just we can predictably say that most people are going to be some level of disabled at this point in their lives. And so we're like, okay, well, we'll deal with that. Disabled people are the same as old people in that context, right? Like, they deserve the same. They deserve the same. It's just because old people weren't disabled for a while. Shut up, okay? Shut up. Anyway, Luke.
I would also say that one possibility is like reduction of crime.
Yeah, that is a suggested one, yeah. Mm. Why would that be?
Well, because I think we can all agree that some crime, at least, is motivated by the fact that people don't have enough. Some people will, for example, steal something because they are desperate. And if the idea that you could become so desperate that you need to literally threaten and hurt people in order to get your basic needs met was eradicated, some of the crime may be eradicated.
So what you're saying is to avoid wage theft, we should give Jeff Bezos more money, right?
What?
So because Jeff Bezos needs money, that's why he's in a desperate situation. That's why Amazon, his company,
yeah,
is so horrible to workers and, you know, makes them not allowed to go to bathroom breaks, fires them sort of indiscriminately, makes them do dangerous things, you know, to save money. And that money is being saved and given more or less to Jeff Bezos, right? Because he's desperate.
No, I always say the opposite, which is that the only reason people put up with those conditions is because they don't have a choice.
Oh.
And it's almost like universal basic income in some ways would function as like a universal union.
Uh-huh.
Not in the sense that it's bargaining for people, but in the sense that it gives people back their sort of bargaining power.
With their labor.
Because one of the things that's sort of the fallacy of the fallacy that unions try to fix is that people can bargain for better conditions. Well, maybe they can't. Maybe they don't have any money. A lot of people live paycheck to paycheck and they can't bargain for better conditions. Well, if you took that condition, they could take that situation away from them, they might be able to be like, actually, I don't want to put up those conditions.
Yeah.
I can get by for a few weeks on my UBI.
Yeah, it shields people from exploitation because they're not facing starvation, death.
Which will make things better for everyone, including the companies. You'll get better companies.
But Jeff Bezos won't get all his money.
Oh.
He won't get all his fake numbers that he can see on a screen and make himself feel bigger than Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates or what other white man he wants to feel better than on that particular day, you know. Who will go to space, Luke? Who will go to space on their own whim?
We can have government space programs. They were pretty good.
That would never work. Are you telling me the government could get a man on the moon? Huh? You telling me that, Luke?
You're right. Sorry, I'm an idiot.
Think before you speak.
Sorry, that sounds like we're conspiracy theorists now.
Different podcast. Very different
dear.
Podcast.
No, we believe in the moon landing, to be clear.
Are you telling me that a government, Luke, could make it so that the trains don't cost an obscene amount and are actually relatively good? You saying a government could give us decent public transport? Is that what you're trying to say?
Sorry, I'm not being that ridiculous. Come on,
no?
Corey.
No, okay, no. Good. Because that would be absolutely...
It's only the private sector that could do that, Corey.
Exactly. Just like the private sector is the only way that we can have affordable energy for all of our homes, right?
Precisely, yes. Thank you finally for putting the words into my mouth.
Ah! Anyway, yeah, no, that's another, lowering crime, but not just in the sort of, let's say, petty crime, you know, or blue-collar crime, right? But also more sort of white-collar crime, sort of corruption and whatnot, right? Because with these means-tested things, there are people who stand to benefit from, you know, not giving people money, you know? Like, for example, if there are quotas that you've got to hit or whatever, right? Where, for example, I was saying with Pip, right, with ADHD, there are ways that you lose money with ADHD compared to a non-ADHD person. And so you can get a grant from the government that's, you know, a couple hundred pounds of untaxed income every month, maybe, or, you know, just under £100 of untaxed income every month, right? You get that, right? But to get that, you've got to call up and speak to someone and go through a whole process, and it's lengthy, and it's not a good thing to make disabled people do. It's a relatively difficult process. And at the end of that, and this is just for people with ADHD, right? This statistic, 50% of the people with ADHD who apply to get this thing don't get it.
No. Nope.
It's like a 50% success rate. And that doesn't make sense, because half the people, like, if you have ADHD, there is a measurable cost associated with that, right? So why should you be rejected from that? Because, you know, the things that they try and catch you out on are, you know, like, oh, well, you said that you weren't able to do this, but you've said that you can do this one specific thing. Well, that means I think you're able to do this other thing. So you don't get it. You're not disabled enough. Sorry. You know, there are people who stand to benefit in sort of broader ways, right? Corruption could be an issue there, right? Mm. But outside of that, there's also institutionalized racism or other forms of bigotry, right? If you've got means-tested stuff, that means that someone has to decide who gets it. And if that someone is racist, they can wiggle things a little bit to restrict people who need to get, like, who, you know, should get something, who deserve access to something from accessing it, right? So you could have people that are kind of stalling the process for people of color, or you know you could have governments who are like, okay, well, the way to do this is to send in a form, and the only way to get this form is from, you know, the post office, and it's not accessible, it closes at certain times, all of that sort of stuff, right? Like, there are all these sort of different ways of not necessarily stopping people from being able to access something outright, but just making it so difficult that, you know, most people won't do it. It's like, have you seen Nathan For You, which I don't think you have seen. You have seen one episode of it. Anyway, it was with me. You see Nathan For You, there's an episode wherein he advertises. So Nathan For You, by the way, this is a massive tangent, is a show wherein Nathan Fielder goes to businesses, small businesses, and tries to improve them with, improve as in big quotes, with really sort of zany, outlandish ideas. It's a ridiculous show. It's somewhere between sort of a reality show and almost a prank show, except the joke is on kind of everyone. It's not the point. Anyway, one of the things that he suggests is, if you're a gas station, right, make the gas like half the price of everyone else. And he's like, I can't do that. And he's like, yeah, no, make the gas half the price of everyone else. Then people come in, they fill up their tanks, and they're like, okay, I want my gas, it's half price. And he's like, yes, it is half price, but it's full price right now, and you get a rebate, right?
Sure.
And the way to get the rebate is to go up to the top of this mountain and just put your form in the box at the top of this mountain.
Yeah.
But to get to the box at the top of the mountain, you've got to stay there all night on this, like, retreat. And so a bunch of people actually end up doing it, because it's saving them, like, somewhere between, like, $17 to $100, depending on who they are, right? And some of them start going through with it, and a bunch of them drop off, obviously. Like, a load of them, when they're told, you just put it in the box at the top of this button, they're like, whatever, I'm just going to eat the money, right? I'm just going to eat the cost, because I'm not doing that. And it's the same sort of idea where if you say this thing is accessible to you, it's available to you, but you just make it difficult to access, right? Yeah. Like you just add a few barriers in there. It can really restrict a lot of people. That's why voter ID is not a great thing, because there's not a huge issue with sort of voter fraud. But introducing voter ID restricts people who don't have a government-issued ID, you know, it restricts them from voting, which just so happens to be a lot of people who don't want to vote for, you know, right-wing folk, or otherwise known as the people who want to implement voter ID. Anyway, that was a big, long tangent. Any other pros for UBI, Luke?
Well, I suppose there's an awful lot of sort of social stigma attached to applying for benefits. Like people don't. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of negative press around like benefits, claimants, and you don't want to. You also just emotionally might not want to feel like you're like accepting help from the government, and you're like, because people might call you like a drain, mm-hmm. or like there's a lot of social stigma in that sense, and it might not feel nice. And so you might be sort of incentivized not to do it, either by just the way you feel about it or the way other people feel about it. Whereas if you were just helped universally, that might be quite nice.
Yeah.
And might make the world better and nicer for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something, everyone can get this. It's like, for example, right, like I remember during COVID, right, there was a thing for self-employed people where it was just, here's some money, here's some untaxed income from the government. And... you know, that was, there was no sort of like, you know, there's sort of bad thoughts around this. There's sort of like bad vibes. Everyone I know was like, yeah, even if I don't feel like I really, really need it, I have lost income. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to take it. Right. There was no sort of stigma around that there. And yeah, social stigma could be a massive issue there. Lack of knowledge is another one. Right. Like, you know, I didn't know about personal independent payments until... late last year. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, I feel like a lot of people probably don't know about the benefits that they could be claiming just based on, you know, how their lives are already. Like, you don't need to be, this is a very, very sort of not great way of putting it, but you don't need to be as sort of disabled as you think to qualify for some kind of payments, right? Mm-hmm. It's always worth looking into it. But that's the thing, right? Like, there's not enough knowledge out there about all of these sorts of programs, right? And we've already mentioned the difficulty of the process as well. Another one I think is really important to mention is that if you've got universal basic income, people won't suddenly start earning less for working more. Have you heard of that sort of situation where you're on benefits, you know, or you've got some kind of welfare payment, right? And that's conditioned on you not being able to work or not being in work. Or being working under a certain number of hours or anything like that. Now, if you go over a certain number of hours, if you make a certain amount of money, then that payment just comes out, right?
Yeah.
But then you've lost more, you end up losing money, right? So for example, let's say you're on a £50 payment, right? Every month. And if you earn more than £100 every month, I don't know why I'm doing month, those numbers are very, very low. Let's say a £500 payment and you're earning, and if you earn more than £1,000 a month, you lose that £500 payment, right?
Yeah.
So you always want to be earning £1,000, right? Because then you're getting 1,500.
Yep.
As soon as you earn £1,001, you're earning £1,001. So if you earn £1 more per month, you lose £499.
Yep.
Right? And I actually worked with someone in a bar who was like, I have a maximum number of hours that I work every week. Because if I work any more than that, I lose, like, you know, they would lose benefits that they had. They had a couple kids as well. It's like, you know... you could say, oh, well, you're a drain, you should work more, blah, blah, blah. It's not possible for them to necessarily work more, right? Yeah. And why would people be incentivized to work more if they're going to be worse off for it?
Yeah, you know? We usually have some pretty good, like some fairly good ways of dealing with this. So like some of the benefits in the UK, at least, for every like pound you earn, you get like 33p less or 50p less. So you're still ultimately incentivized to work. Now, there may be examples where that's absolutely not the case and it's really bad and it just drops off, in which case it's poor system design. Like, you've just done a bad... There's no incentive. Like, you're incentivizing people to do less and to take more. That's a stupid system.
Yeah.
Just objectively a stupid system. And that's definitely the case. It may be the case in the UK, and it's definitely the case in other countries that it is like that. And that's just bad.
It's not actually done in such a way that it's going to incentivize people to work or help people out of poverty or do anything sort of terribly useful other than keep people just riding the line, really.
Yep.
And yeah, like all of that can kind of fall under what you were mentioning towards the beginning of just the admin load, the load of sort of the bureaucracy and all of that sort of stuff, right? If we were to just say flat payment to basically everyone, you wouldn't need to be having people sort of double check, oh, is this person claiming the right amount, or are they getting the right thing, or, you know, like, oh, they didn't get their payments because somebody made a mistake and blah, blah, blah. If it's just everyone gets it, it's a much easier process, you know, much, much easier. Right. So those would be the arguments for. Do you have any idea of the arguments against?
Yeah. And there are some. Mm-hmm. The first one, which is relevant to what you were just saying, is that if you at the extreme, if you went, OK, we'll just scrap benefits completely and just give everyone a UBI and we'll not have any of this bureaucracy. Well, then the opposite, you get the opposite problem, mm-hmm. which is that there are people with additional needs that do require their needs assessed so that they get more money. Like mm-hmm. if they need to have, for example, my granddad was very disabled and they had a shower, like a special shower put into their home, mm-hmm. or they had a special car that had to be adapted to allow his wheelchair in it. You need to have that.
Yeah.
So you still need to be able to assess people who have greater needs than the basic income and give them more money, as we currently do, to adapt their life.
Can I just say, that's actually really interesting, because that wouldn't necessarily be an argument against UBI. That would be an argument against having UBI and scrapping everything out. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, that's
yes.
That's not an issue of UBI in and of itself. That's saying UBI doesn't completely solve all social problems. Which,
sorry, yes.
No, yeah, don't yeah. apologize.
It's more it's a counter to the argument for UBI
yeah.
that we could reduce bureaucracy, which we obviously still could reduce bureaucracy. It just might not be reduce it to zero.
No, absolutely. I'm not having a go at you there at all. I just think it's really interesting that, you know, if you pick out one of the arguments that people will often give against UBI, because I'm sure you're not giving that as an argument yourself for why you don't believe in UBI.
No.
But yeah, no, as an argument against UBI, it's not actually attacking UBI in any way. It's just saying, oh, well, it's not enough. It's the same as sort of arguments against veganism, right? Where it's like, yes, veganism may reduce whatever, but have you seen how much water almond milk uses?
Yeah.
Have you seen how much water soy uses? Yeah, still less than cows. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you know, it's not perfect, but it still works. Yeah, no, carry on, though.
Okay, so let's attack UBI directly then, is what you're saying. So on the economic side, one of the most important things that sort of, not so much a government, but for example, a Bank of England do, which we are currently living through at the moment as we're recording this, which is sort of the cost of living crisis, inflation, and the Bank of England raising interest rates in order to combat inflation, is that the Bank of England need to, in economic terms, sort of maintain demand for the currency. And if you sort of detach the currency from value, right, from sort of like an exchange of value, right, so you're giving the money out, and you're not getting anything in return, there's no transaction going on, the fear, I don't know if this is true, I don't know the research, but the fear is that you're reducing the perceived value of work, you're reducing the perceived value of the pound or the dollar or whatever currency you're doing, and you might create inflation, depending on how you fund the UBI. You can fund it through taxation, and then fine, you're not going to fuel inflation, but you might fuel sort of inflation in wages, for example, because people now want more money, because they've already got their basic needs met. So they're like, well, if I'm going to go to work, I need to have my lifestyle increase much more because I'm already fine without doing any work. There's a few things in there. But the main one I would say that's the thing that we'd need to pay attention to is the inflation of the pound and maintaining demand for the currency in a world where at least some of the currency is given out for free, sort of universally. That's not something that can't be done. I'm just saying it's something that has to be managed.
No, yeah, absolutely. I think as well, we need to be quite clear that universal basic income, UBI, right, in, I would say, the sort of purest sense or the sort of best case scenario, right, is paying for all of one's basic needs, which is housing and, you know, food and all of that sort of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily that much money, you know. It could be, I mean, like, even a grand a month is, like, for the UK, that's a fair bit. Like, a grand a month can probably do you, like, depending on where you live, almost definitely not in London, but a grand a month can do you, you know, most of your basic needs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sorted, right? And then on top of that, it's like, well, then it's just sort of sort of leisure, right, or other sorts of things. And if you've got good socialized healthcare and a lot of other sort of social safety nets, and you know, let's say really good public transport, or really these sort of cities that are really built for bikes or 15-minute cities and all of these sorts of things, right, you would see sort of things you want to spend money on decreasing, right? You wouldn't have people wanting to buy or needing to buy expensive cars if they don't need to drive anywhere all that often, and public transport is actually really good, and actually it's really cheap to get a train from one end of the country to the other, so I don't really need to get a car because it would be a less convenient option, right? If you have all of these, so in a utopia, in a perfect society, these kind of a lot of those problems might fall away, right? Where it's like, oh, well, actually, if I'm going to work, I'm going to need more money because... Yeah, I don't know how much I sort of buy that people would be like, yeah, actually, now that I'm not under threat of not being able to survive, you need to pay me much more money to get me to do anything. Do you know what I mean? Like, wages would increase, maybe, probably, but I think only to a point where they're fair. You wouldn't have sort of really unfair sort of poverty wages existing anymore, which is ultimately sort of a net good. No?
Yeah, well, it all depends. Like, ultimately, it's a really big, intricate system, and if you interrupt it, it's got to go somewhere, right?
Yeah.
So, like, the excess that you've done has got to go somewhere. Obviously, money and economics is really just a way of keeping track of things, right? And so, we don't know what would happen in a situation where you detach the value of money from any specific commodity, right? Mm-hmm. Other than the small amounts that we do in terms of benefits, and those probably have other social good things going on because you might reduce hospital bills, you might reduce some crime in some places, those kind of things.
Ooh, well, we'll see. I'm glad you chose those two specific examples. That's a very good one. Save that in your mind for later.
I guess what I'm getting at is that one of the problems when you're creating a utopia is that you need to. You're only controlling one country, right? You're only controlling your own country. Every other country doesn't automatically sign on.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are suddenly giving lots of money out, right? So imagine, say, for example, you printed the money. Like, you just made money out of nothing, mm-hmm. which we do. We did during COVID. We did during the financial crisis. We do that, right? That does happen. You've now got an awful lot more of that currency, and you need to trade with other countries in order to buy the things that you import.
Yeah.
Assuming you don't make everything inside your country, which basically no countries do. Not even North Korea does that, I don't think. They get imports from China. Anyway.
Don't tell the North Koreans that, Luke. Don't let them know. They would be cross if they found...
Oh, we thought Supreme Leader made everything in this country, no?
So this is very dark. Continue.
Anyway, and so you've got to maintain the value of your currency and the demand for your currency whilst printing lots of it.
Mm.
And there are ways to do that. And one of the ways to do that is via taxation. And so if you put up taxes, you might disincentivize work that way because people are going to be, you know, if you're getting £1,000 a month for free and you can earn £2,000, but another £1,000 goes on tax, you might be like, well, what's the point? I'll just lower my standard of living and do more labor in my house and not earn any more money.
Yeah.
Right. So that it's a really complicated system. And the sort of excess has got to, in theory at least, it's got to go somewhere, especially when you are competing with other countries in a competitive system, and other countries don't necessarily have to accept your currency. And if there's loads of your currency sloshing around and they don't want to hold any more of your currency, they might not want to buy anything in your currency, which means you'd have to sell your currency to buy dollars. And then that reduces the value of your currency again, and you might just get hyperinflation and go to zero. So I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
I have no idea if any studies have been done on a gigantic scale, but it is more complicated to have UBI when you're the only country doing it. If every country did it, it might be easier.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned that, actually. Hold that in your mind for just a couple of seconds. I want to mention a couple more arguments that are given against it that we've not really gone in depth about. The cost, which we kind of touched on, I think, people who don't necessarily need the money are going to be in receipt of it as well. So you're paying people that you don't necessarily need to pay. So it's maybe a bit of a waste there. There are ways of getting around that. And also it's sort of a cost benefit analysis as well, right? Like, for example, yes, you may be giving out a lot of money that you don't need to give out, but you might also be saving way more money in admin costs, or there are other benefits that might not, you know, be foreseen by just giving most people an amount of money such that it the extra money that you're giving to people who don't really need it doesn't really matter all that much. There's also work ethic productivity, which we kind of spoken about, we touched on there. People might be less inclined to work if they've got a safety net. They don't have, you know, the stick of starvation, death, homelessness, prison, you know, keeping you going. And then also dividing resources that could be other better applied to other areas of, you know, public life or public well-being, like health, education, etc. But what you were saying there about it being really complex, right? You know, UBI potentially affecting so many different things, especially if it's just in one country, you're not doing it with all countries because countries need to interact with each other, you know, and your currency is not dependent. The sort of value of your currency is not dependent just on what's going on within your country. It's how it relates to other countries as well. Mm. Yeah. That is very true. And that's really related to why it's so difficult to study UBI, because finding out whether or not it sort of works empirically isn't necessarily as straightforward as one might think. It's obviously about as complex as you think it is, Luke. You've got a very good estimation of it. But there are different criteria for determining whether it works or not, right? Like, if you sort of think about it, different studies might be asking different questions, because, you know, what we might, you know, say is a good system that works is not what someone else might say is a good system that works, you know? The goals of governments are complex, kind of like you were talking about there. Like, you know, it's not just, oh, the people in our country have money and are able to survive. It's also, how does our country, how does our currency weigh up against other countries, right? But you've got to take into account a lot of different factors, you know, if you're implementing these kind of policies. And something might be very beneficial in one way, but horribly sort of negative in another. And so you need to weigh those things up. It might conflict with other interests. And really, I'm so glad you said what you said, because I literally have written in my notes that society is like a house of cards or a food web wherein, you know, one thing, changing one thing could affect everything else in a way that you might not expect. Like, mm-hmm. one small change could have all come falling down like a house of cards, or, you know, a change could have knock-on effects in multiple different areas, like a food web, right? If you introduce a new animal to an environment, you have no idea what's going to happen. That's why invasive species are like massive issues, right? Because we're like, oh, cool, I'll just introduce a cane toad to to this country, and I assume that will solve, oh, it's made the problem worse. And so UBI could be like the cane toad.
Yeah.
But it could also, you know, be like something else that isn't a cane toad. A rabbit. Rabbits aren't from here. There you go. It's also important to know and recognize the difference between different countries, you know, low-income, middle-income, high-income countries, right? Like, the effects of UBI are going to be very different, and the cost of UBI are going to be very different depending on the sort of general income of the country. So I've just got a quote here from the IMF. Typically, policymakers face trade-offs along the following key dimensions: coverage at the bottom of the income distribution versus leakage to richer households, generosity of transfers versus incentives and economic distortions, such as those related to the decision to enter the labor market and the number of hours worked, fiscal cost versus alternative use of scarce fiscal resources. Policymakers must also consider a fourth aspect, how to reconcile objectives and implementation challenges, such as the government's capacity to raise resources equitably and sustainably and roll out a complex transfer program. Do you know what essentially that was saying there?
So basically, in summary, what I think they're saying there is kind of some of the stuff we've already touched on. Firstly, how do we make sure poorer people are getting it and we're not just giving a bunch of money to rich people who don't need it?
Yeah.
How do we make sure that people still want to do some work and don't massively reduce the amount of hours that they work? Mm. Weighing up what else could we spend this money on? For example, like improving public transport or hospitals and things like that, which would also benefit most people in some way. And also how to raise the money in a way that's fair, rather than, for example, what sometimes happens is just taxing the middle class to hell, not taxing the rich enough, and giving the middle class people's money to poorer people, and then the rich people just stay rich.
What?
That happens?
They would do that?
No way!
That's
and also, like, how the hell to build such a complicated system.
Yeah.
And also, it was something it's sort of baked into that. How do you build that system in a way that it's not going to be scammed, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, in COVID, we had loads of something like billions of pounds worth of fraudulent claims.
Yeah, because there were all those people who the government got to, you know, perform certain tasks or fulfill certain needs, and it was actually just their mates running the companies, right?
That's not actually what I'm talking about.
That's not, you're not talking about that kind of fraud. Oh, you're talking about a different
Yeah.
Oh, right. So we're not talking about cronyism in our government. No, okay.
That was bad too.
Oh, no, talk about
but
something else.
There was also a bunch of like fraudulent claims for COVID for support or COVID loans.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
By companies that didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And there's literally billions and billions of pounds that the government's never going to get back. And it's too much work to look into it. So that's how you design your system so it's sort of resistant to that sort of fraud.
We can waste billions on something like that. Why can't we just solve homelessness?
Yeah, that would, yeah.
I mean, if you're going to take a gamble and do that, like, why don't, just solve it. Just do it.
Well, Corey, we did solve homelessness for a bit during COVID.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I forgot that we could just do that.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot that we could just do that. I forgot that that was an option the entire time. And we're we'll save it for when there's a pandemic and we really need, you know what I mean? This is like when you're playing a video game, right? And you've got an item in your inventory that you're like, oh, I don't want to use it. I know it's there. It's a very good item. But if I use it, it'll be gone. And then you never use it. That's what solving homelessness is like for our government. They're like, oh, got a chip that we could pull out when we need to, but don't know. Don't want to waste it. Just waste it. Just solve homelessness. Just do it.
Corey, how will we get people to work and not do drugs if we don't tell them that homeless people make bad choices and are lazy?
Oh, that's so true. I suppose we could just put everyone who touches a drug in prison, right? That would work. Not the politicians and
not Michael Gove.
No, sorry. I should be clear, Luke. When I said people, what I actually meant were the underclasses and not actual people, the rich.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We should put all of the others who touch a drug in prison. And that will disincentivize it probably, right? You know, I mean, if you're living a really difficult and not fun life, like and touching a drug sends you to prison, surely you wouldn't touch a drug, you know, to get out of your miserable life.
Still might, actually, yeah.
God, we really don't understand people, do we, Luke? We really don't. No, but, like, in all seriousness, it is baffling that, like, just not solved homelessness. I know it's a very complex problem, and it's there are many, many different sort of factors involved and many different areas that need to be tackled in order to solve it sustainably. But also, like, just do it. I feel like, honestly, if a government were like, yeah, you know what? It's going to be our goal to end homelessness. And they just did it. They just did it. People would be like, wow, okay. Well, I mean, they did it.
They did it.
Yeah, like, okay, I guess my community center has people sleeping in it at night now. And that makes me feel like it's a messier place. But, like, they solved homelessness. And I would be a pretty terrible person to be like, well, no, they need to go out in the street. So I guess I have to vote for them again, you know. Or feel like a terrible person. Just fucking solve homelessness and you'll win all the votes forever, probably. Right? There's no way the Tories can spin solving homelessness to be... They can do it, but, like, the BBC would help, but, like, it wouldn't be an easy one, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't think that many people would vote to solve homelessness.
No, I know.
I think they really wouldn't. That's really sad. Like, imagine looking at the ballot and being like, solve homelessness or, like, £100 less tax for me? £100 less tax for me.
But I will give £100 to charity. Because it makes me feel good.
And I get it off my taxes.
Ugh, yeah, not good. Not a good position to be in at all. Don't like how things are or how people look at the world. Anyway, back to UBI. So we've spoken about all the different things you need to consider. And the one last thing you want to consider is long-term and short-term effects. Obviously, you know, something could be not sustainable, but be very good in the short term, like drugs. Or it could be sustainable in the long term, but not great in the short term, like different drugs.
Yeah. Like antidepressants.
Yeah.
Bad for a bit. Then that stuff sounds better.
Probably good.
Hopefully sometimes.
Yeah, or makes it just worse.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so as we have so expertly sort of described, UBI is a lot like drugs. Good or bad, depending on who you ask.
Don't know till you try it.
No. Don't try drugs. Unless your doctor tells you to try drugs, but only if they've given you a prescription to try those drugs. Don't just go to the doctor. He's like, mate,
you gotta try smack, man.
Yeah, you gotta try smack, dude. Here's a tab of acid. Just like go home, sit by yourself, put on some nice music, chill, right? Like, you have a great time. If your doctor's doing that, one, coolest doctor ever. Two, probably not a great physician, so you want to look into a different GP.
I actually did once. Am I going to say this on the podcast? Oh, yeah, whatever. I actually did once tell my doctor I had tried a drug. I think I can't remember.
I had caffeine. Please don't be mad. That's what Luke said.
And the doctor was like, was it fun? And I was like, yeah. He was like, cool. That's a genuine thing that happened.
What are you telling this, actually? Good God. Wow.
I like that because I was like, okay, my doctor just doesn't care. My doctor is not judging me and would rather I tell them that medical history than not.
Yes, if you do drugs regularly or not, you probably should let your doctor know. In confidence, obviously, because it can be important for your health to know whether you've got, you know, coke cutting about in your body. Like that's something they should be somewhat aware of, or something else, a different drug. Luke,
drugs.
Was looking for something a little bit more specific, but you know what? Whatever. Let's just go to an ad break.
Ling, is that the ad bell?
I hope so. We don't have any other bells in this room.
Well, I'll tell you what we don't have in this room, Luke. We don't have people who have subscribed to SciGuys on YouTube and followed us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
I actually have done all those things.
I have too. But why don't we tell people about why specifically that is a very cool and interesting thing for them to do?
Well, we want to be everywhere with you all the time. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, we want to be there with you. If you're on Spotify, we want to be there with you. And if you're on YouTube, we want to be there with you. And you probably want us to be there with you too.
Even if you prefer to listen on Spotify and don't really watch us on YouTube all that much, it really helps if you subscribe on every single platform because it gets us in front of more people, which means it makes it easier to make this show, which you love, right? You love it. You love us, right?
Give me love. Validate my soul.
Subscribe to SciGuys on YouTube and follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify right now.
Heal the deep, deep chasm in my heart.
Let's get back to the show.
So let's talk about UBI trials. Luke, do you know anywhere that's done a trial on UBI?
They did a trial in Africa, I think.
Could you be more specific than the continent of Africa?
No. Oh, sorry. Yeah, that's really bad. That's really bad. It was sub-Saharan Africa. I know that's not more specific, but it is more specific. I know that we were going to be doing a trial in Wales.
Oh.
I think the Labour...
Do many people live in Wales?
Yeah, a few.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought it was just Jonah.
Oh, I see.
Pinocchio and Geppetto also lived in a whale for a brief time.
I was like, there's a man in the Bible who lived in Wales? How incredible. Why don't I know
that's just
this?
The one whale, actually.
Okay, we were going to be doing a study. It was either on UBI or it was on the four-day work week, or both, in Wales. But I think the Tories stopped it. That might have been the four-day work week.
Oh, wow, you're really good at foreshadowing. Anyway, let me tell you about a few different countries. So UBI has been tested in a decent number of countries, in a decent scale in a few countries, more than 10, some of which are Japan, China, Kenya, Spain, Namibia.
Yep.
Namibia.
That's where I meant when I said Africa.
Really? It wasn't Kenya?
No, it wasn't Kenya. I'd remember Kenya.
So those countries, Namibia, Japan, China, Kenya, Spain, those are just some of the many countries wherein, UBI has been tested at a decent scale. But I want to talk about a place that is, it's so painfully obvious that this is something, you know, that exists there. But I've never actually considered it, right? I've known about this since 2007, I think, but never considered it until I looked it up for this. Alaska, the Alaska Permanent Fund.
Oh,
you heard about
yeah,
this.
In the Simpsons movie.
The Simpsons, that was, that I've got in my notes here. You might remember the joke about it in the Simpsons movie. Do you want to sort of repeat that joke?
So the joke is that they drive into Alaska because they're moving to Alaska and they just get given a big wad of cash.
Yeah.
And basically, as far as I understand it, Alaska basically pays off its residents to go, thank you for letting us have all the oil, and just gives them some money to be in Alaska.
To ravage our state's natural resources.
Yeah.
Yeah, so since 1982, the state-owned corporation, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, uses oil revenues to provide annual dividends to every Alaskan resident, well, who's been there a full year and intends to stay. There are some caveats on it, but if you're a resident in Alaska, you're more likely than not able to receive this sort of annual payment. And it's not just adults, it's just any resident, right? So a family of four gets four.
Yeah. No way.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so cool.
So, as I said, joked about in the Simpsons movie, but it's usually about $1,000 a year, varies depending on oil prices and some other factors, because as you've said, it basically comes from the government kind of as a, here's money, here's a bribe for us to use oil. Essentially, they use money from oil in Alaska to fund this, and so it is dependent on how much sort of oil prices are, how much money oil makes in that given year. So it's not a consistent amount necessarily, but it is, you know, it is £1,000 a year. It's not a lot, but it is, it's more than nothing, right? Mm-hmm. It's a fair amount every month. And yeah, it is basically a bribe from the government to let oil companies just get more oil from Alaska, which, you know, isn't a great thing to think about, but maybe we should ignore that for a moment and just look at the positives of it. So in 2015, it was $2,072. 2017, it was $1,100. 2023, it was $1,312. It can sometimes go as low as $800 to $900, but as I've said, it can go up to $2,000. Again, depends on oil prices, some other factors. And if you think about it, a family of four, right? 2023, mm-hmm. last year, that would easily be like, you know, over 5,000
mm-hmm.
In a year, which is, you know, not a huge amount, but it's significant.
A week.
Yeah, it's a significant amount, right?
Well, $100 a week is like what some of our UK benefits are.
Right, yeah.
It's like £100 a week.
Yeah, absolutely.
£80 a week, I think, is some of the sort of lower benefits. Yeah.
Yeah, so that would be an extra £100 a week. Ish, $100 a week ish for a family of four, right?
Yeah.
And that's nothing to sniff at. It's not going to cover all of your living costs, but it is a significant little bump. It also can provide, like, you know, a bit more of a safety net for you. Oh, well, I've got, like, you know, an extra $5,000 every month. Even if you don't use that, right? And you just put that into your savings, saving $5,000 a year, it's pretty decent, right? It's really tough to study the effects of this fund, though. Do you have any idea why that might be? So it was started in 1982, and then, you know, if you want to study it from 1982 onwards, why might there be difficulties in finding out what the effects of this fund were?
Well, just like in all of economics, you basically can't extract one of the variables out of all of the variables that might have changed over that time, so you can't really do science in economics. Like, economics wants to be a science, but you can't, like, go, like, I'll change one variable in lab conditions and see what happens.
Yeah.
You can't extract that data out.
Yeah, no, you can't. And it's much more difficult to do. Basically, the situation there is that, you know, let's say in the 5 years before 1982, lots of things happened, right?
Yep.
Lots of different changes were made. There were different sort of things going on in the late 70s that affected, you know, the public well-being. It affected crime rates, affected, you know, unemployment rates, all of these sorts of things. So you wouldn't be able to compare the 5 years before that fund started to the 5 years after, because the fund isn't the only variable there mm-hmm. that has changed. So any changes you see could be the result of literally anything else, right? And so what they do is you also can't just compare it to different states as well, right? So you wouldn't be able to compare Alaska to California or Alaska to New York or Alaska to Wyoming or Idaho or Oregon or... Stop me.
Go on. No, carry on. Carry on. This is great.
Or...
Colorado.
I don't know. Colorado. Yeah, that's a good one. Or Texas or, you know, Mississippi.
Florida.
Or Florida. Or North Carolina.
Oh, yeah.
Or South Carolina.
Yeah.
Or...
New York.
New York. I've said that already.
Oh.
Or Virginia.
Oh, yeah.
Or Where West else? Virginia.
Anywhere else?
Or, God, I don't know. Rhode Island.
Ah.
Or...
Anywhere you could compare it to? No.
No, what you could do is aggregate a lot of different details from a lot of different states
yes.
to build a model that's sort of a control, right, that is similar to what you would expect Alaska to be. So if you look at how Alaska compared to different states over the past 5 years or the past 10 years or however long, and you try and you'd be like, okay, well, how these things relate to each other, you could try and build a model of what you would expect Alaska to be like were there not sort of, let's say, a UBI mm-hmm. or there weren't that sort of Alaska permanent fund, right? And when they did that, by combining a lot of different states' data in very scientific and complex ways that we won't get into right now, mm-hmm. What they found, part-time work seems to have increased, and the employment rate didn't seem to be significantly affected. And a quote here, this is from a Vox article, I'm sorry, I looked up all the other information elsewhere, this is a good quote from a Vox article, sue me. Okay, sue me. There are two things that could be going on here. People could be shifting out of full-time work and into part-time work because the dividend checks gave them money, enabling them to work for shorter hours. And people who weren't working before the cash payment are driven to start working because of it, perhaps because it helps pay for transportation, childcare, and other fixed costs of employment. So there are more people in part-time work, right? Why might that be? Well, you've been given a bit of money. Oh, cool. I can go and work part-time now so I can spend more of my time doing other things. And like, that may not sound great if you're like, oh, but employment should be high, but it might sound good if you, I don't know, want your population to be happy and productive.
No,
okay,
definitely not.
You want them to be inefficient for greater efficiency, right?
No, efficient but miserable.
But that's inefficient. Miserable is inefficient.
Not if I whip them.
You are aware that people have access to guillotines.
Of course.
Yes.
Yes.
Don't whip them too much.
People have access to guillotines. Sorry, can I just pull you off on that? How would you access a guillotine if you needed to get one?
I just make one. Not that difficult, Luke.
Okay, fair. Just a weight.
I need a few blocks of wood and a sharp. Like, it is not that hard.
Okay.
Like it. No, I'm not joking. Yeah. Like, seriously, Luke. I need a rope, some wood, and a sharp thing. And in reality, it probably doesn't even need to be that sharp. I just need a heavy thing and a strong bit of rope and some wood. I could chop off so many heads. How many heads I could chop off before anyone could stop me? Like, probably quite a few, right? The hardest thing would be sourcing the people. But, like, you know, if you've got enough people who want to chop off people's heads, you know, you could do that. You could what are they going to do? Send me to jail? I'll chop off the police's heads. Will they come to get me? Oh, yes. Come and get me, officer. Yes. Come. Just pop your head through this hole, I will come out. Boom! Got him!
It feels like a guillotine is a very inefficient way of like, chopping off people's heads when they're coming to get you.
Yeah, well, what I'd do is I'd sit in a hole, right?
Oh, yeah.
And I like and it'd be fully covered. And so they'd stick their head through this hole to look for me. Something. I'm in here.
Like in a cartoon.
I'm in here. And they think it's just a wall, you see. So I'm hiding in the walls.
Yeah.
So they stick their head through.
Yeah.
Dink, chop, boom, fall.
I think that would work for maybe the first person.
Now, you'd think that, right?
Sure.
But what I've just realized is there's also a trap door.
Ah.
Boom, boom. And then it flops down, the person falls into the pile, and it would only become a problem when the pile becomes so high that the trapdoor doesn't fall anymore.
And of course you just dig the hole deeper.
No, Luke, I'd empty it out. Can you imagine the smell of an entire pile of policemen and politicians rotting? Have you ever smelt rotting pork, Luke? Oink, oink, that's what it would be like.
Why are the politicians coming to your house?
Because they're canvassing, I don't know.
Canvassing? Hello, I'm from the Labour Party. I just poke my head through your little hole? Oh no!
I promised I'd donate to their campaign.
Just so you could source more people to chop heads off.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
I don't know. I'll tell them, I know what I'll do. I'll say, guys, I bought Epstein's Island and I've started it back up again, but this time, it's totally chill. There's no list. It's all on the blockchain. And they'll be like, oh, that sounds cool. And then they'll come. They don't understand how the blockchain works. Okay. They don't know that makes it worse. I don't want to be on Epstein's list, but I'll be on the blockchain.
The blockchain.
Woo! So essentially, if you look at this, right, if you weren't working before, you know, you got that cash payment, as I've quoted there, you might be more inclined to work afterwards because, oh, well, I've got enough so that, like, you know, if you've got to travel to work, for example, right, not everyone's able to walk to work because this country and many other countries are horrible hellscapes designed to make us feel terrible so that we can buy more things. Mm. Keep buying. Don't stop buying. Keep buying. Keep buying. Speaking of, go buy some Sci Guys merch. Buying is goods. Anyway, if there are costs associated with working, costs that you can't avoid, you need to be outside of your house, which means you probably need to eat a meal, which means you either need to have the time to make a sort of packed lunch, or you might have to buy something whilst you're out there. And depending on how hard you work and all of that sort of stuff, you know, you might not even have the time to sort of make yourself something ahead of time, right? So you might then have to get a meal at your place of work. If you work in a bar or a restaurant or something, they might give you a meal that's discounted and you have to pay for. Yep, I've worked in places that have staff menus that you still have to pay for the food. Staff menu is not the whole menu. It is...
Oh, really?
No, it is specific things that you get discounted. Yeah, it was ridiculous, honestly. It was not good for... £1 chips? Sounds great. Not good when you you know, you want to try and eat healthy. Anyway, not the point. But, you know, so if there's costs associated with working, like traveling to work, you know, for example, if you want to travel to SciGuys, Luke, you need to travel all the way from your place to the SciGuys studio, which costs money, right? Mm. There are costs associated with that. Childcare costs as well could potentially be a thing. And there's this thing called a cost-benefit analysis, Luke. Have you ever, have you ever heard of that?
Yes.
It's where you analyze...
Yes. Both the cost and the benefit. And you weigh them up. Does the cost justify the benefit? I will analyze.
That's, you understand cost benefit analysis better than anyone I've ever met in my entire life. Stephen Bartlett, who? No.
Welcome to Diary of CEO.
How did I do it?
Cost benefit analysis.
Yep, and I definitely didn't get lucky. I just worked harder than everyone else.
Yeah.
No luck whatsoever.
If you're down on your luck, it's your own fault.
Yeah, just work harder. If you're not a CEO, it's because you're objectively a worse person.
Mm, well, I always say.
It is. Without provocation. He just says it. I've asked him to stop and he won't. He said it at his wedding instead of his vows. It was very uncomfortable. I do.
Work harder than everybody else. Yes, I do. And if you don't work hard enough, it's your own fault.
He got booze. Anyway, it's sort of a cost-benefit analysis there, right? Where you look into it and you're like, well, hold on. I stand to potentially lose money from working, you know, especially given how much it's going to affect. Like, you know, for some people, the cost of childcare takes up basically all of the money they'd be earning if they went to work. So it makes more sense for someone to stay at home instead of pay thousands for childcare if you're only going to be making, you know, thousands. It's like, oh, I'm either losing money or breaking even, right? It's not worth it. Whereas if you get that little bit of extra money, it might then become more worth it. So that's the USA, right? Alaska, kind of an interesting pilot for that. And it does seem to have worked, you know, it seems to have benefits there. If we look at Canada, there was a program from 1974 to 1979 in Manitoba. So every citizen in a city called, or a city, a town, a little sort of farm town called Dauphin. Dauphin, it's French, doesn't matter.
Oh, Dauphin.
Fine.
Probably.
I don't care. It's a place name. You can Google it, right? How I pronounce it is not important to the story. And we spent a lot of time on it, and we're continuing to spend time on it, and I'm going to stop right now. So they were given the choice of participating in a randomized controlled trial on UBI, every citizen in that little sort of farm town. So high school graduations increased, health seemed to improve, both mental and physical, hospitalization and doctor visits decreased. It was cancelled by conservatives after 4 years. That's why I asked you to keep that in mind.
Yeah.
A little bit foreshadowing.
They do that.
They do. And adding on to that, in 2017, Ontario launched a three-year pilot program in three cities. It lasted until 2018. You have one guess as to why that was.
Oh, did some Tories pull the plug?
Yes, Conservatives did.
Yeah.
They did. They did just cancel it. The reason being, Luke,
I thought the Conservatives hated cancelling things.
Luke, no, they hate cancelling...
This is cancel culture gone mad. You're cancelling all these UBI trials.
They hate cancelling transphobic authors, transphobic comedians, transphobic politicians, transphobic educators. They don't like cancelling transphobes. They think that's rude and mean. They should be allowed to be transphobic.
What if a bunch of transphobes ran a UBI study? It would never get cancelled.
Simply implode, wouldn't they? Yeah, but then trans people wouldn't get the UBI. That's the trade-off. That's the cost-benefit analysis.
So it's you. The you is like almost everyone, unless you're trans. Oh, transphobes. Oh.
Conservatives cancel it. The reason being is that they'd heard that it disincentivized participants from finding work. It also hadn't run long enough to have any usable data, but they cancelled it. Anyway, 4,000 low-income people were supposed to be supported for 3 years, but they just, they weren't. I've got a quote here from the London Assembly. In September 2021, the University of Essex published research on behalf of the Greater London Authority, which assessed how COVID-19 had affected levels of financial hardship in London. Part of the research looked at the effectiveness of government measures to protect incomes, including universal basic income, during the pandemic. The research showed that introducing a universal basic income of £80 a week in London would decrease poverty by 5.7%, bringing 130,000 Londoners out of poverty. However, this would come at a substantial cost to the taxpayer, as it would be funded by a tax rise of 3 percentage points for each tax bracket. Why don't we just tax the rich a bit more and bring everyone out of poverty?
Yeah, well, they control the government, so.
But, like, just
Well, you know.
It's just, you can have one house. Like, I think you should not be allowed to have a second house.
Yeah, I saw a video online, actually, of it's like Politics Jail or something, with this person going around interviewing people, talking about whether they like the level of taxation they have. And this lady was like, you know, I have two houses. I don't consider myself rich. I think that's what she said. I'm going completely off memory. But the vibe was not like, oh, I'm extremely lucky and I've got more than I need. The vibe was like, you know, I only have two.
She's comfortable, yeah.
I'm comfortable.
Yeah, I have double the number of houses that one needs to live in. You know, realistically, more than double, because one person can share a house with another person. Perhaps two smaller people also. This is my polyamorous. This is my polycule. Me and my three partners.
Two smaller partners.
They're just smaller, yeah. They're not children. No, they're. I see why you might have thought that, but no.
I didn't think
this
that.
This isn't a nuclear family. No, this is a this is a polycule. But no, yeah. I don't think you should be able to have two houses as long as some people have zero houses. That feels unfair.
Yeah, I think that's an okay rule.
Yeah?
If anyone's not got one house, you can't have two houses.
Yeah, that's
not enough house.
I'm sure someone will be in the comments chiming in to let us know why it's actually really, really horrible to restrict people from having more houses than they need to live. What if they want to work in one part of the country and live in another? Tough luck. Sorry, I mean, honestly, sorry, who cares? Like, I don't care.
Well, but also, we could just... that is obviously the case that people do that, but we can make that more efficient. Like, we can make it cheaper to rent places, for example.
Mm, like, yeah.
It would be more efficient for you to rent a place when you go across the country. Now, obviously, you might want to store your stuff, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, cool. There are problems to it. Fine. But then the fact that there's always one house empty at any one time is also a problem.
Yeah.
That's also a problem. Yeah, and it's stupid.
Until people, we can have the conversation about needing multiple houses when everyone has a place to live, right? That's fine. I think we could put that off until then. You know,
could you have a room in one house?
Yeah,
and the rest of the house is inhabited, and
Luke,
there's one room.
I'm going to excite you so much. You're going to love this.
Oh yeah, go on.
Houses tend to have multiple rooms.
Ooh.
So you could in fact have a room in a house, but more than that, you could have multiple rooms in a house.
Oh, goodness me.
Yeah, right.
That's so exciting.
It's crazy. But no, you are right. Yeah, someone could likely just have a room in a house, kind of like an Airbnb, but not terrible, you know?
Yeah.
Remember when Airbnb was good?
Yeah, there was a small amount of time that happened.
Yeah, very, very short. And then it became just this, just what it is now, which is hotels. But
yeah,
worse.
My wife went into an Airbnb in Los Angeles and she turned up at the address and it turned out the Airbnb wasn't there and it was in a different part of town. And they got a taxi to that different part of town and the taxi driver was like, you sure you want to get out here? Are you know this area is not safe. And then we contacted Airbnb. They were like, we don't care. There's no refund for you. The guy who owns it can give you a refund if he wants.
If he wants, yeah.
And I was like, what are you flipping? These are two. There was three women in a country that they don't live in being driven to a place where the taxi driver was like, you sure you want to get out here? And the address on the listing was in like this lovely area. And the, yeah, not cool.
Yeah, no,
Airbnb,
I think I know.
Contact me and give my wife a refund. That's crap. Your support were very bad.
Honestly, yeah. Like Airbnb are like that. And in LA, It's not a great place for Airbnb. I mean, it is. There are tons of them. But, like, it's expensive and they will swindle you.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on from that. Yeah, the fact that poverty could decrease by 5.7%, 130,000 people in London could be better off. But 3 percentage points for each tax bracket? Why don't we just make it more percentage points for the higher tax brackets? And none for the lower. I don't care. Okay, so that would be the London Assembly. That was their trial. Give Directly, that's a non-profit whose goals are to give cash directly to those in need. Rory Stewart, is it Rory Stewart? You know Rory Stewart?
Yeah, sort of Tory dude who's a little bit better than the rest.
Yeah, yep. He is now the head of the charity after when he was financial boy, however long ago. He was like, no, this is a dumb idea. Giving money directly to people in need? Stupid. I won't
really
have any of it. Oh. And now he's apparently just become the head of the charity. I have no idea. I shouldn't say charity, the non-profit. I have very little idea of this non-profit. I saw the head of it on Twitter. Seemed nice enough from a brief glance. And I looked at their about page very briefly. This is a study that was run by them. Not run by them. Run by... Two of the people who run the nonprofit were involved in this study, but the operations of the sort of nonprofit were separate from the study, right? So there's a potential conflict of interest there, you know, because whatever. But like they were facilitating the providing of money to people. Mm-hmm. I think this was in Kenya, I believe. In Kenya. They were facilitating, you know, giving the money to people in Kenya, but I don't think they were involved very much in sort of the study itself, if that makes sense. So go and look into it yourself. Take what you want from it. I'm not sort of endorsing this nonprofit here because I don't know enough about them to endorse them. I'm just letting you know who ran this study we're about to talk about. So some researchers, along with the heads of the nonprofit, as I mentioned, they're running a study. It's still happening, but they've released sort of preliminary data from it. So roughly 200 Kenyan villages were split between three groups and started receiving payment in 2018. The three groups are long-term UBI. So that's 12-year basic income of $22.50 a month, which is $540 total after 2 years, with a commitment for 10 more years still to follow. Short-term UBI, 2-year basic income of the same amount, $22.50 a month, which is $540 after 2 years, with no extra income to follow. And then a large lump sum of a one-off $500 payment given, given at the start of it, so 2 years before the sort of current point that we're looking at this from, with no more to follow. So that doesn't sound like a lot, but if you're living below the poverty line in Kenya, that's less than $33 a month or $400 a year. So getting an extra, $500 over 2 years, $540 over 2 years is, a significant amount, right? And so after 2 years looking at that, they found that they invested, they became more entrepreneurial, and earned more. This is all quoting directly. The common concern of laziness never materialized, as recipients did not work less nor drink more. So apparently the large lump sum and the long-term UBI were effective. But the lump sum let people make big investments, and so that was better in a number of ways, which this is a difficult thing, right? If you think about it, I would always have thought, you don't want to give people a lump sum. You want to probably give them just monthly payments, because if you give someone a lump sum, there's the risk of it just all going, you know, like people who win the lottery and suddenly lose it all very quickly. But yeah, if you give someone a lump sum and it can go towards, a big cost, that does also make sense as well, right? Like if you give people a lump sum when they turn 18, it's like, okay, go buy a house now.
Yeah, and it also might be just that people can afford to take risks, not necessarily needing the money to take the risk itself, but knowing that if the risk goes wrong, I'll be okay for a few weeks or a few months.
Yeah.
Because I've got this money saved. It's not necessarily, do you know what I mean?
No, I don't. I mean, when
it doesn't necessarily pay for something, it just allows you to do something that might go wrong.
Well, yes, when I quit my job a number of years ago now, quite a while ago, 4 years ago now, during the pandemic. So yeah, almost 4 years ago, I had a few months of rent and bills, just money, just there as buffer, not to go to anything in particular, but like, okay, I'm making money, but if I stop making money for 2 or 3 months, I will be okay. You know what I mean? And like being able to build up that money, awesome, like actually awesome, did it through the job that I'm doing now, I think, was the only reason I was able to do that, because I was working two jobs essentially. But like, yeah, having that sort of safety net there to be able to take that kind of risk is phenomenal, because if it wasn't for something like that, we wouldn't be able to be doing this right now. You know what I mean? Like, we wouldn't be sat in this little studio with all this stuff, because I need to take, I wouldn't be able to do this if I had to work another job, right? That sort of like safety net so that you can take risks, absolutely. A very, very big sort of benefit of, some kind of UBI. Essentially, some of the things that they take from this are, people feeling more encouraged to save money or take risks, as you've mentioned. One sort of insight is, as I was kind of saying, that sort of lump sum. It gives a sort of idea of how this could be implemented, right? So different governments could look at this and be like, okay, well, this might actually be a good way of implementing this. Like the lump sum might be better than, sort of monthly payments. So at the end of every year, here's your amount of money, do with it as you please, which again does make sense, because you wouldn't then need to be saving the money up, potentially spending it on different things throughout the year, if you could just have it all at once. But it improved agency and income. Overall, there is no evidence of it promoting laziness, as it said, but evidence of substantial effects on occupational choice, impacts of total household income are also positive and significant. So you know, basically what that's saying there is that, you know, people didn't stop working. In fact, they were more, they were like, you know, they had more choice in what they could do for work, right? They actually were more likely to work because they were able to work at something that they, well, not necessarily because, but they were more likely to work, and they were more likely to be able to work in a sort of role or position that they actually wanted to, right? And something they'd be engaged in, which makes sense, which is a good thing. I think having people do jobs that they are excited to do is good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Generally, it would be less stick and more carrot.
Yeah.
There's talk of doing something similar-ish to this about maybe, I can't remember, it might be in the US, might be in the UK, I can't remember, about the idea of like putting, for example, £2,000 or dollars or whatever into an investment account for every child that's born, right? And then that grows, and then they end up with a lump sum when they presumably turn 18. And that sort of has the same sort of effect, which is it doesn't cost an extreme amount for a government, but if you have the money saved and then it compounds in whatever it's invested in over 18 years, that does end up being a very significant amount of money by the time the kid is ready to use it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, makes total sense. I mean, all of these different ideas are essentially, I think, kind of gently pointing at the fact that the system we have right now just doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't. Like, we wouldn't need to be injecting money into people's lives if we had a functioning sort of, I guess, fiscal system, an economic system that actually functioned well enough to keep people healthy and happy and surviving and all of that, on all of that sort of, you know, basic stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think that's partly why UBI is so hotly contested, because it is essentially just an admission of failure, right? It's like, oh yeah, no, what we're doing right now doesn't work. You know, it doesn't really work at all. The idea of forcing people to work on the threat of death, essentially, right? It's not that great a motivator, right? And especially given that so many jobs are just pointless and boring now, people don't feel good. Like, you know, if you're out working in a field where you're like farming, yes, it's a much harder job, but also it's probably better in a lot of ways than I don't know, working in middle sort of management or working in sort of marketing, working in some sort of metaphorical field that isn't actually providing any sort of real value or worth, right? Like, it's probably more fulfilling to go out and just do manual labor where you can think and you can be around people and all of that sort of stuff, rather than get really stressed about absolutely pointless things all the time.
I think it also gives you a sense that the system you're working for looks after you.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, maybe some people think it's idealistic, but I think when the system feels like it's rigged against you, or when what it's doing is going, if you don't do what we tell you to do, then you'll die, or you'll be homeless, or you'll whatever. It doesn't encourage you to work within the system. It encourages you to cheat the system.
Yeah.
Especially if you're at the bottom of the system, right?
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't encourage you to go, oh, right, well, I'll work for this really nice system that's helping me. Whereas if cheating the system would kind of feel like cheating yourself,
yeah,
because the system ultimately does look after you, even if it's in a slightly detached way, some, I would hope most people would ultimately feel that they're better working in that system. And obviously, you've got to protect against, if there are people who do try and defraud a system, you've got to try and protect against that. But I think I definitely feel better about working in something when I feel like the thing works for my needs and everybody else's needs, rather than disproportionately not for my needs.
Yes, that is a fantastic point. And just before we finish, I want to talk about UBI and health. So I saw it described as prescribing money, and got a few papers, a bunch of stuff linked in the description, but just one thing I'll mention, because we've been going for a while. This has been a long episode. The mental health effects of a universal basic income, a synthesis of the evidence from previous pilots, a 2021 sort of paper that was published. Essentially what they found from looking at a whole bunch of studies is that mental health outcomes improved with UBI overall, sort of generally, right? And if you look across the board, what it seems to kind of point to is that wealth increases with UBI. Health increases, both mental and physical, with UBI. It generally just, things are better off. The main argument against it would be the cost of it. But there are ways of doing it so that the cost isn't sort of huge, like if it's offset by income tax or something along those lines. Complex stuff that I don't really need to think about because I don't need to care about that sort of stuff, sure, personally. But yeah, there are different ways of paying for it that, you know, can limit the burden to the taxpayer. You know, for example, like Alaska, who just get the money from oil companies, and the burden is then on everyone for having a worse sort of environment to live in. But that's not the point. Ultimately, it seems that UBI is probably a decent enough idea, but it's really hard to get a grasp on how good of an idea it is because it's a difficult thing to study. So you can find sort of wildly varying results, particularly, you know, from people who have a different sort of view of the sort of benefits and how they weigh up to the quite the literal cost of it, right? So yeah, it is a really complex subject, but I think you and I both agree UBI is probably a decent idea. You know, at the very least to stop people from dying from no money.
Yeah, and at the very, very, very least, the sort of general concept underlying UBI that it would be nice if we all looked after people,
yeah,
and that some people being incredibly rich is not worth some people being incredibly poor and unwell. That's the general idea there. You call us big old socialists, but that's the general idea under there. Look after people to a basic level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's socialism.
I guess that's good.
More like Luke Comrade.
Yeah, Luke Comrade.
So, last one. After the entire episode, what's your opinion on UBI? Do you think it works?
I don't know if it works.
But do you think it might work?
I think it might work, yes.
Okay, good. I agree. And now it's time for the Quickfire Quiz.
Dun, 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 dun. Universal Basic Income Edition.
So the rules for the Quickfire Quiz are the same as always. I'll ask one question. That's one question between you and the audience. The first person to answer the question correctly after finished asking the question wins. What do they win, Luke?
An unconditional payment from SciGuys.
That's what we get. And we can barely afford ourselves.
Thank you, patrons.
So let's not give it out to anyone else. Thank you, patrons. Or we might actually die.
All right, they don't win that. You win nothing.
Just like what you get if the government joke inserted there. The question for you is, what does UBI stand for?
Universal Basic Income.
Ding, ding, ding. That is almost correct. It's not a Universal Basic Income. It's Universal Basic Income.
I think I said actually.
It's not Universal Basic Income. It's Universal Basic Income. Not a double U. It's just a single U. Just like you used to be until you got married. Anyway, that's all from us. Before we go, we'd like to thank all of our patrons with an extra special thank you to executive producer Glitch Rabbit, and thank you for listening. You can find the full references for this episode down in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Monday, and why not leave us a nice wee review? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com. SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotGore everywhere.
You can follow me at LukeCutforth everywhere.
Good.
Bye.
Bye.